In an economy that is 70% consumption, you really are playing with fire. If you lower rates enough to prompt retirees to begin selling their stock market holdings. So it's a fine line that the Fed is going to be walking after the first 100 basis points of rate cuts.
Than just a regular gym routine. When was the last time you checked on your financial fitness? If you're feeling like you're falling behind, Ed Sedell is here to help with The Retirement Trainer, a podcast about helping you get into better financial shape. Every week, Ed talks about things you need to know to become more financially fit for your future. Learn about things like how much money will you need, financial mistakes other people often make, and how you can avoid them. Plus, details on The Retirement Fitness Plan, a plan Ed personally created to help you get to and through retirement by focusing on five key areas of your financial life. Learn more about The Retirement Fitness Plan when you visit egsifinancial.com and click on processes. Then subscribe, follow, and listen to The Retirement Trainer on Apple Podcasts, your iHeart app, or whichever podcast platform you prefer.
Danielle, how are you this morning?
I'm fine. Maybe I should turn the video on. Yeah, there we go.
Well, thank you for coming back on the podcast. I really appreciate it. The timing is impeccable, for sure.
It doesn't get much more historic than today.
No, it really doesn't. I mean, there's so much to talk about, for sure. And even though we gave a really good introduction before the show started as to who you are, your background, but because of everything going on, I think it's really important to reiterate that you're really an insider. Your background is being part of the Federal Reserve for Dallas for 9 years, but not just any 9 years. It was during the financial crisis all the way through 2015. So you were there in the thick of it, right? You left in 2015. You were advisor to the president of the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank. And when he retired, you left. And then you wrote a book. You authored a book, which I thought was fantastic, my personal opinion, Fed Up, an insider's take on why the Federal Reserve is bad for America. And here we are, right? I mean, this is the reality.
And here we are. Yes. Yeah. And we're about to see history be made.
We are. And here's the thing. So you and I, we're up to speed. You are the preeminent expert as an insider as to what's going on. And you and I can really talk about and prognosticate what's going to happen tomorrow going forward. But over the weekend, I had conversations with some friends of mine who are our clients. And last night, I had dinner with some very dear friends who are also clients. What I realized is that most people aren't up to speed like you and I are. They really don't grasp the purpose of the Federal Reserve, what they're really supposed to be doing. There's so much white noise as to, are they political, apolitical? You know, they just really understand what's happened in the last couple years. Do you mind just kind of giving, as an expert, just a little background onto maybe even why the Federal Reserve was allegedly created, what their charge is, what they're supposed to do, and then we can kind of get up to speed as to today going forward. Do you mind doing that?
Not at all. Happy to.
What's the purpose of the Federal Reserve? What was the intent? Why was it created?
On a practical level, the founding of the Federal Reserve had to do with two main events. One was J.P. Morgan, the man, realized his mortality. We don't think about the United States economy as being very bumpy, right? But throughout the 1800s, it really was. The economy veered in and out of not just recession, but financial crises. And the financial crisis of 1907 was a turning point because J.P. Morgan did what he was expected to do and what the world had become accustomed to him doing. That is, I pull everybody from all the biggest banks into my parlor room in Manhattan, and I don't let them leave until we resolve the crisis and everybody commits to doing whatever they need to do to settle down the financial system. Mm-hmm. And you know, at that point, he said, I'm no spring chicken, and I won't be around forever to kind of orchestrate, coordinate these rescue efforts. And the second event was, we, the United States, were no longer at that juncture an emerging economy. It's hard to think that the words that we use, EM versus DM, emerging market versus developed market, hard to imagine, but the United States was an emerging market. But by then, it had turned the corner. We were at the precipice of supporting the rest of the world's economies throughout two world wars. We were, you know, within a decade of that moment when we became the financial power, superpower of the world. And the difference between an emerging market economy, when you think of a revolving door in a country like Turkey, for example, where the president makes sport of getting rid of the head of the central bank, the United States had become a developed economy. We needed a Bank of England. We had evolved to that degree. We needed an entity that could step in the event another financial crisis broke out, and we forget, be lender of last resort. That doesn't mean bailout. It means providing liquidity to a solvent system when liquidity dries up for exogenous outside reasons. And by the way, they threw in, you should protect the purchasing power of the US dollar while you're at it. And that was always kind of central banks' main purpose, main reason for being, was to minimize inflation. And at the roots of the Federal Reserve's beginnings, that really was the only mandate that policymakers had, was minimize inflation. And in times of crisis, and by the way, in times of crisis only, and for a penalty rate, in other words, you're going to punish those who need emergency liquidity, haircut them, if you will, then you step in during times of emergency as the lender of last resort. But again, you're lending into a system that is inherently solvent. Now, we've seen a lot play out. My time at the Fed was throughout the great financial crisis. It's got that name in front of it, the G in front of the GFC. The great financial crisis was plagued with concerns of insolvency. And, you know, was Bear Stearns solvent and not just illiquid? Was Lehman Brothers also solvent? And the dominoes started to line up. Gee, if Bank of America is going to buy Countrywide, is Bank of America solvent? And the questions kept getting bigger and bigger, right, along with the financial entities involved. And it was time for the Fed to step in. And that's kind of where we find ourselves today. The other only historical milestone I would mention would be when Mariner Eccles, whose name I can never say, whose name's on the outside of the now very controversial Fed building. It was originally called the Federal Reserve Building, and then it was named after Eccles. When Eccles put his foot down in 1935, Congress amended the Federal Reserve Act to make sure there was a distinct separation of the U.S. Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve. We also, at that time, brought in 14-year terms for Federal Reserve governors, the seven governors who serve. And the idea of a 14-year term, which is very critical to the discussion that we're having today, is that the governors were expected to have terms that outlasted any political administration, and thereby that further indemnified them from any political type of interference with the Fed. And so it's important to point that out. Eccles was asked to step down as being chair of the Fed by President Truman. At the time, he said, that's just fine. 1948, I'll step aside as chair. But by the way, my 14-year term is not ending, and I am going to exercise my right to stay on and finish my term as a Federal Reserve governor, which Eccles did, and made sure that that separation between the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department came to pass in 1951 with an accord that formally split the two, ensuring the Fed could be an apolitical institution, fully independent. And all of that history is extremely relevant to where we find ourselves today.
Yes. Absolutely. So let's talk about, and by the way, thank you. That was fantastic. Let's talk about today. So it is historic on so many different levels. Honestly, it's not just about what are the Feds going to do tomorrow, but it's about that. It's about Cook. Is there really a separation? Are they truly apolitical, or are they a political animal? Are they always playing catch up? I mean, why do they seem like they're always behind the eight ball as it relates to decisions? Do you mind just kind of giving your perspective as to where we're at today? And then we can kind of get into, you know, the future and what we're seeing going forward.
Well, you know, as I said, in preparation for this Fed meeting, the major media outlets always want what we call talking points.
Right.
And my very first talking point said, the meeting on September the 17th, which is my birthday, by the way, but the meeting on September the 17th has more to do, has more to do with who is sitting around the table than what is being discussed. When markets have fully priced in, I think, 96% probability of a 25 basis point rate cut, Federal Reserve officials do not like to surprise the market. They don't surprise the market. And so we know that we're going to be back in an easing mode as we were 1 year ago at the September 2024 meeting. It's a given. And that takes us to the who. You know, I was thinking last night after 2 hours trying to get out of Boston Logan Airport, where, by the way, I give you fair warning, today is day 76 of runway closure. So prepare your patience if you're flying through Boston Logan. But I found myself thinking about the idea of first degree murder versus manslaughter. And that sounds kind of hyperbolic. In no means do I mean for it to be hyperbolic, but it comes down to the idea of intent.
Mm-hmm.
So if Governor Cook put down on two separate documents that it was her intent to use a second home as a vacation home, and then in another separate document, it ends up being revealed that there was primary residence listed on two mortgages within just a few, I want to say weeks or even months, maybe even weeks of each other.
Right. Yes. I think it was weeks.
Then it will come down to intent. And that is what the Supreme Court is going to be deliberating when it decides the case that will surely go all the way to the Supreme Court, because a federal appeals court has ruled that it appears that the intent to mislead was not present, and that therefore Governor Cook would be able to continue fighting this case while serving in her capacity as a governor. So her vote on Wednesday, September the 17th counts and will not be in question, for the time being until the Supreme Court decides. Now, when the Supreme Court does make this decision, it will be pivotal in U.S. history because it doesn't just apply to whether or not a sitting president can remove the head of a federal agency, even one that is independent, or one of the officials who critically have been confirmed by the U.S. Senate.
Mm-hmm.
The Supreme Court's ruling will then apply to other federal agencies going forward, other administrations in the future that would then theoretically have the legal latitude to pick and choose who should be where. And as we know, the knife can cut both ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we've seen that, right? You know, on one side did one thing and the nuclear option. And when sides change, you know, it backfires. It blows up in their face. And we have to be very mindful of that going forward. Big picture, right?
That is
the reality.
And completely separately, you know, there is great controversy, and rightly so, that Stephen Miron did not step down from his position in the current administration. Now, this is a direct violation of the spirit of the Federal Reserve Act, because in order to truly be an independent, nonpartisan, apolitical member of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, which the Senate has confirmed him to be, he was sworn in as a Federal Reserve governor shortly after for a very short four-month stint. Mm-hmm. But it's unheard of that the full commitment is not on the table. He's putting his pay in the administration on hold while he's at the Fed. So again, it wouldn't matter which side you might or might not be on. This is a dangerous precedent, because you need for all governors to be completely independent in their analysis and in the data that they present, in their positioning themselves as a dot on the dot plot, all 17 members of the Federal Open Market Committee must be independent in their thoughts, actions, and how they present their view on monetary policy going forward. And,
Above reproach. That's the reality.
Beyond reproach.
Because perception is reality. And right now we have seen and continue to see over the years, do as I say, not as I do. I think people, everyday people, are saying, well, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. How can you make decisions that is really affecting, and I'm talking about Main Street versus Wall Street, right? Main Street, that's affecting my family. We can barely make ends meet. There's not enough money left at the end of the month, but yet you're taking liberties and receiving the benefit of maybe not doing things the right way, right? So how can you make—
And yet being fully in that position of power.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. So
these are real thorny issues to contemplate. They really are. And I guess what's most fascinating to me is the treatment of being a governor for just 4 months, when in fact, here's irony for you, Lisa Cook served out a very short period ending somebody else's term in the same way that Myron would be ending Adriana Kugler's term, which was scheduled to end in January. But she was immediately reconfirmed for a full 14-year term. You know, Myron theoretically could be in line for the very same, placing him in his position for the longest of anybody on the Federal Reserve Board. Right now, Lisa Cook, should she be allowed by the Supreme Court to continue in her current capacity, her 14-year term ends in 2038. So she is currently the longest potential standing member of the Federal Reserve Board. Myron would then surpass her in terms of how long he would be there. But again, he hasn't even committed to do anything but stepping away for 4 months. This has brought up all kinds of other controversies for Treasury Secretary Scott Bennett. There was kind of an open plea on the part of Kevin Hassett's peers that hit the media that said they're concerned that he would be willing to replace Powell should Myron leave after 4 months and that position come open. That position, by the way, has to come open. I was mentioning Eccles in 1948. His continuing on in his capacity as a Federal Reserve governor meant that the seat that he would have vacated as chair remained occupied. Chair Jay Powell has the same exact set of circumstances that he faces because his term, his four-year term as chair ends in May of 2026, but he has every legal right to stay on until January of 2028 when his 14-year term ends. Should he choose to not vacate that seat, then there would, and should Cook be indemnified by the Supreme Court, then there would have to be a seat that opened up for President Trump to fill.
You know what? I did not get that till you just explained it. Holy cow. It truly is historic. Wow. I never thought about it like that. I mean,
if you really, really, really want to, when I came to this next understanding, and this is as somebody who was on the inside for 9 years during the crisis, even I learned something, and that is the Federal Open Market Committee votes in the chair of the Federal Open Market Committee. So not in theory, but in practice, President Trump could have an opening. Myron could step aside if Cook is not made to step down. Mm-hmm. If Myron did step aside and President Trump was to put somebody in as chair of the Fed, the larger 17-member Federal Open Market Committee could then, it is absolutely within their legal rights, vote to keep Jerome Hayden Powell as Federal Open Market Committee chair, meaning he would continue to be the individual behind the podium after Federal Reserve meetings, not the chair of the Federal Reserve. If you think President Trump is angry now, he'd be mad as a hornet. If Powell was able to maintain by vote of the committee his position as chair of the Federal Open Market Committee of the FOMC, but it is fully a possibility.
Wow. Like I said, I didn't get that until just now. And I think this is why they're so indignant in making sure that Cook, who is not above reproach right now, based on allegations, I just say it that way, making sure that everything is done the right way, because otherwise, holy cow. All right. So let's talk about this. So if he has the ability to chair that committee, so what impact does that have on the dot? Well, first of all, let's explain what a dot plot is. I mean, you and I know what is the dot plot and why is that so important when people are predicting rates now going forward for next year?
So four times a year, all 17 members of the Federal Open Market Committee indicate anonymously their answers are plotted, what their expectations are for medium-term and long-term inflation, where they see that, where they see medium and long-term the unemployment rate, and where they see the federal funds rate over the same medium and long term. So where do we see inflation headed? Where do we see the unemployment rate headed? How many rate cuts or lack thereof or rate hikes do we see in the near term and the long term future? And of course, it's that last one that everybody pays such close attention to. How many rate cuts? How many rate cuts is the market pricing in? How many rate cuts do Fed policymakers see going forward? What is the difference between those two? How will that be rectified? That brings us to why the Fed is data dependent, because they will shift their views theoretically if the data supports their being more hawkish or more dovish going forward. But people pay very close attention to this dot plot because investors invest.
Right.
Investors, this is not monopoly money. Investors invest real money. And the key deciding factor in where the markets are headed.
And this is why during the summer, when several members of the FOMC voted against that and actually changed their views, why the markets kind of rallied a little bit, because it gave an indication as to where things may be moving going forward.
Yes.
Because of that dot plot. And so how far out? So you have the near term, but typically how far out from long-term expectations does the dot plot go?
So I want to say right now, and I fear you can't quote me. I always say I don't know.
No, that's all right. I'm not going to hold you to it.
But I believe it's year end 2027.
Okay.
It might be 2028 at this juncture, but it's one or the other. It's, I tell you what, when Jay Powell was initially a rookie chair, one of his very first press conferences, he threw out the dot plot. He stomped all over it saying, it's great that we pretend that our crystal balls can see that far out over the horizon. The fact is, they can't. And the dot plot itself is very subject to change beyond the immediate term. And he's right. And
no, we've absolutely
seen, we've seen changes over the years, because who can see that far into the future? You just can't.
Over the last couple of quarters, I mean, you know, what was predicted and expected didn't happen. It actually kind of reversed itself a little bit. So, and I do get that. And even Jamie Dimon's comments, you know, over the last couple of months, I think have, I don't want to say shaped policy, but maybe shaped public opinion based on different data. So let's talk about that for a minute. So the feds have really kind of shifted their focal point of data to really the jobs numbers. So we saw a revision downward last year, continually month after month. We saw another revision for last year downward of 911,000 less jobs than what was it just for last year. So why is that so important? I don't think a lot of people understand the dependence of the feds on those jobs numbers, the impact that that has had on their decisions, and why the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, why that position is so important because of the impact of the decisions that it has on the FOMC.
After 2022 being kind of a gigantic positive revision, we've subsequently had not one, not two, but 3 years of deeply negative revisions. And even though revisions, I say the word, most people's eyeballs roll into the back of their head, but the revisions have actually taken the jobs numbers down to such an extent that we now know that net job destruction began in the second quarter of 2024. That's a long time ago. Just in U.S. history alone, we've never had net job losses commence without the economy already being in recession prior to that juncture, because unemployment is considered to be the most lagging of all economic indicators. But just stepping back for a second to the biggest picture, if you think about job losses beginning in the second quarter of 2024, it is no longer a mystery why Americans went to the polls and voted for change. Because even though the data on the ground in real time, which is largely imputed using a birth death model that is very much a subject of controversy right now at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in fact, the Department of Labor has opened up an audit into how these numbers are created because they've become systemically unreliable. But now you understand that even though real-time data was saying the United States labor market, to echo Jay Powell, was solid on the ground, to use your Main Street, Wall Street divide, people on Main Street knew darn well that we were in recession. And that's why they voted for change.
Absolutely. And we all knew that there was a recession, but the numbers were saying otherwise. And that's why it goes back to that old saying, right? You know, all of our econ professors said the same thing, right? There's lies, there's damn lies, and there's statistics.
Statistics. There is a footnote to this story. And that is, I promise you, what Federal Reserve policymakers are discussing today and tomorrow. And that is that the annual benchmark revision that was negative 911,000, the largest nominal decline in the history of the series, that was for the year ended March the 31st, 2025. Now, it's what's happened subsequent to that big release. And that is that we've now seen deep downward revisions May, June, July, and including two sectors that we thought were bulletproof, like construction. We now know that we've had three consecutive months of losses in the construction sector. The manufacturing sector is getting increasingly weak. The job losses in that sector are weakening on the factory floor in America. So what Fed policymakers will be focused on is, gee, it looks like even after these deep negative annual revisions, that the downward momentum gained steam. We actually had the pandemic notwithstanding, which was a very noisy time when you had this man-made closing of the economy and reopening of the economy. So we economists tend to look through that period as being noise. But the pandemic notwithstanding, June's loss of jobs, June 2025's loss of jobs, was the first negative print for non-farm payrolls since September 2010 that we knew.
Really? Oh, I did not realize that.
That we knew so soon. Now, we've seen deep negative annual revisions that then go back and rewrite history. But in terms of real-time weakening in the U.S. economy, despite the birth-death model adding thousands and thousands of jobs every month, which was the case in June, by the way. Despite that, we still have enough negativity in the data. In fact, my good friend Anna Wong, who's chief U.S. economist at Bloomberg, and we concur with her analysis, it looks like when the dust finally settles on June of 2025, that we'll probably have something more along the lines of, instead of a negative 13, 14,000, whatever that June number was, after those 2 months of revision, It looks like we're going to have a number that's closer to negative 60 to 75,000 for June of 2025. That is real on the ground, bleeding, bloodletting in the job market. And that's what Fed policymakers, that's why their shift has moved towards the labor market, even as anxiety continues to run high about tariff pass-through.
So, all right, we all know, right? I think you and I agree that the market has already priced in 25 basis point, 0.25% reduction in rates. Okay. There's been talk that it could be 50 basis points, 0.5%, you know, and there could be two or three more rate cuts this year and then going into next year, right? A lot of prognostication based on numbers, but, you know, it remains to be seen as these revisions continue to happen. So having said that, based on what you just said, where do you think the rate cut should be, maybe not just tomorrow, but between now and the end of the year, based on the data that we know so far and where things are heading, the trend?
So back to who is sitting around the table may be more important than what is being deliberated. We could possibly see a triple descent Now, we saw a double dissent at the September 2025 meeting because individuals who are in line to potentially replace Jerome Powell as chair of the Federal Reserve Board, that would be Michelle Bowman and Christopher Waller, they both voted for rate cuts to commence in July, at the July the 30th FOMC meeting. So we could easily see, if they see proper justification for a 50 basis point, a half percentage point cut at the September 17th meeting, and they only get a majority vote for the 25 basis point quarter percent cut, you could easily see Bowman and Waller dissent again, and Stephen Miron join them in dissenting, favoring a 50 basis point cut, a triple dissent. I'd have to go way back in my baseball history books of the Fed to find a triple dissent on the part of Federal Reserve governors. But it's entirely within the realm of possibilities if those individuals, unlike July going into September of 2024, when the Fed acknowledged, you know what, we should have been lowering rates in July of 2024. Therefore, we're going to make up for the rate cut we did not push through in June and have a 50 basis point cut in September of 2024. If we don't see a repeat of that, despite the fact that we know that the labor market would have justified a 25 basis point rate cut in May, in June, and in July, now that we have very recent revisions downwards to payrolls, you could easily see a triple dissent in favor of what we call an unusually large rate cut. That brings us back to your question. Going into 2025 at QI Research, we were calling for 4 rate cuts in 2025, a full percentage point of rate cuts. We could certainly still see that play out, even though the market right now is anticipating 3 rate cuts through the end of the year with the upcoming meetings that are left. We're still of the opinion that the October meeting, if you don't see a 50 basis point cut, the September the 17th meeting, we're still of the opinion that if we do see the downward momentum continue in the labor market, you could easily see a 50 basis point cut in October, and then 2 more to end out the year, or excuse me, 1 more to end out the year, adding up to a full percentage point in 2025.
Yeah, I mean, we were expecting 75 to 100 basis points by the end of the year based on, you know, over the last week, just some of the information. But just out of curiosity, Stephen Miron, what makes you think that there is a possibility that he would be the third dissenting?
I mean, again, he's not opting to leave his day job. He's just leaving the paycheck at the door. So right now he's considered to be somebody who's been placed on the board for a few months to stir the pot. And he has advocated strongly for the Fed to get busy with rate cuts, meaning if you only get 25 basis points at his first meeting, at Miron's first meeting out of the gate, he could easily be dissenting in favor of that 50 basis point larger cut.
So why are rate cuts just from, I mean, we can talk about commercial real estate in general, the markets, all of these things, but, you know, as a whole, why in these type of economic climates, why is it so important that we have rate cuts, especially at the levels that we're talking about right now?
Well, you know, so I'm peeking here and here we are. So the National Association of Home Builders Housing Market Index, which literally hit 8 minutes ago as we were talking, was expected to pop up to 33. It stayed at 32. So construction jobs are being lost. Home builders, 87% of Texas home builders are in layoff mode, followed by, I think, 73% in the state of Florida, two of the largest construction states in the country. Jobs are being lost because people cannot afford to buy homes. Now, here's where things get complicated, and this is exactly where you were going with this. Is 25 basis points, is a quarter of a percentage point cut going to make a huge difference? We've already seen that play through to mortgage rates. It's already been priced in ahead of the Fed rate cut. Would another 25 basis points really move the needle on affordability when home prices remain near some of their highest levels on record? I would argue that for many American families, that's not going to be enough of a decline in mortgage rates to really move affordability into a different place than where it is stuck right now.
Yeah, I agree. And not to mention, you know, having the lower rate cuts, you know, the small businesses, lifeblood of America. I mean, you know, taking out small business loans to be able to grow and expand, or honestly, to refinance the debt that they have, laying off people because the debt service on the interest at these higher rates is so much that they can't afford to bring on employees and expand. So, you know, more of a just a broader scope. That's why I think 75 to 100 basis points just this year is important. I know, and you've probably heard the same folks say that they don't think we should, you know, have rate cuts right now still, which I don't understand. But if we want to spur on the economy going forward, not only do we need the cuts this year to pushing 1%, but next year going forward, you know, so what do you think is going to happen next year? I'll share my opinion, but I'm curious as to yours. Where do you see rate cuts going next year? Where do you think they should be to kind of keep the momentum going to get the economy growing again?
So here's where things get really dicey. And at the risk of sounding like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, I promise I'm not. But 20% of U.S. investor portfolios right now is invested in cash. 40% of the U.S. stock market is owned by individuals who are 70 and older. So if you cut the rate that they're earning on their cash too much, you run the risk that they're not young enough to rejoin the workforce anymore as they were in 2001, as they were in 2007, and they did. We saw the labor force participation rate for Americans over the age of 55 increase appreciably in 2001 and in 2007 when the stock market kind of melted down. But they're, by and large, too old to do that this time. And so if there are rate cuts beyond, let's call it today, you're earning 4.25%, let's say that cash income yield goes to 3% or 2.7%, 2.75% with 150 basis points of rate cuts into next year, then will older Americans who again own 40% of the stock market, will they be prompted to start selling their stocks? And could you end up with an impossible decision for Federal Reserve policymakers? Because you don't want to wake up that beast, demographics. You don't want that playing into what happens with the stock market at a time when just today, Moody's announced that the top 10% of Americans, who obviously own, 90% of the U.S. stock market, give or take, that they account for half of spending. So in an economy that is 70% consumption, 70% of U.S. GDP is consumption, you really are playing with fire if you lower rates enough to prompt retirees to begin selling their stock market holdings. So it's a fine line that the Fed is going to be walking after the first 100 basis points of rate cuts.
So do you think the estimates of cash sitting on the sidelines right now, it's, you know, from trillion to trillions, right? I mean, I guess no one really knows the exact dollar amount, but they're in a safe haven. I mean, why would they put their money at risk if they're earning, you know, 4, 4.5% on that money? But if rates start to drop, would there be an equilibrium? You have some investors who are going to sell their portfolio because they're not generating enough cash flow their earnings. And so the market's going to go down. But now you also have the other side of the spectrum where now they've been sitting on the sidelines and now they're going to have to take a little bit more risk. Do you think that that's going to level out, or do you think it's going to be more to the downside? I'm asking because
how much more risk can investors take, for heaven's sake? Right now, they're just
all-time high. It's a little nerve-wracking, right? I mean, every time you turn around, it's another all-time high and, you know, pick an index.
To answer your question, I'm investing myself very conservatively right now. Mm-hmm. So you could see more of what I am doing, which is looking for companies whose dividends are absolutely Loctite, safe, cash flows guaranteed, high dividend paying, high income producing stocks so that you can weather any bumps in the actual stock price because you're getting a nice cash stream off of owning that dividend paying stock where the dividend is safe. I mean, that's a lot of ifs. And that's why you run screens. So to that extent, if you're a retiree, you might be putting money into income producing stocks, but you surely wouldn't be throwing it at a tech company that doesn't pay you
a penny. Absolutely not. Yep. Or, you know, some of the high flyers, right? You know, it's right. Like, okay, what's the hot stock tip? That's definitely right. Having that well-balanced portfolio, You know, the measured risk is so paramount right now. I can't tell you, folks who call me, I'm like, all right, let's go all in. I'm like, eh. Warren Buffett said it best. You'd be crazy to risk what you have, you know, for something you don't need. Why would you put it all at risk for a high flyer, right?
And there's already 72% of U.S. portfolios in the stock market, which is just about a record high. So, I mean, the idea of money on the sidelines to me has always been a bit comical, especially in an environment where sitting on cash pays as much as it does, historically speaking. I'm talking about the current century that has been punctuated by very long periods of zero interest rate policy where you were getting nothing for your cash. So right now, that $7.5 trillion in money market funds is happily earning a 4.25% yield.
Without the risk.
Without the risk. And that's fine if you're 70, the median age of a baby boomer is 71, who does not plan on going back into the workforce. And 70 cents of every dollar of interest income is spent into the economy. Only 2 pennies of the wealth effect generated by an increase in your portfolio's value, your stock market portfolio, only 2 pennies of that increase in value is actually spent into the economy. But interest income, you look at as when you're living on a fixed income, you look at that income stream as being your paycheck in the absence of a paycheck from a day job. So it's a very different dynamic for the U.S. economy, how interest income is treated compared to, gee, my highest flying tech stocks are up even more than they used to be. We've got the NASDAQ on a 10-day historic run, blah, blah, blah. That doesn't mean that those gains are going to be placed into the economy in the form of cash.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So let's go back to the Feds. And then I know you're on a tight time schedule, so I appreciate you taking as much time as you have. But so real quick, the Federal Reserve meeting is tomorrow. What do you think Powell's going to do? Honestly, I mean, it's we're prognosticating, but which way do you think he's going to go? Do you think he's going to stay at 25 basis points and he's still going to look at the data not moving forward because he's typically behind the eight ball? He's always
He will reiterate that he is extremely data dependent, that he remains very wary of inflation. Obviously, we had a lot of downside in the producer price index. The same could not be said for the consumer price index, even though where we're seeing prices rise would be things like furniture, where you can't avoid these tariffs. And yet, we just got fresh data out on retail sales, and furniture sales look terrible. And again, you can't squeeze blood from a rock. You're not going to buy yourself a new sofa if you can barely afford to put food on the table and keep the roof over the head. And we are seeing declines in home prices, which is the largest input to the CPI. But Powell's going to look through all of that and say, we're still highly attentive to the risk that inflation is going to rise. So we're going to remain data dependent despite the weakening that we've seen in the job market, if I had to guess.
Awesome. Well, with that, Danielle, thank you so much for your time. I'm really looking forward to tomorrow. It is going to be very interesting. And this will be up probably Thursday or Friday, so we could look back and see where everything kind of came to a head. So I appreciate you coming on. Thank you.
And thank you for having me again. It was great. Thank you.
All right. Good seeing you.
When was the last time you tested your fitness level? Not your workout routine. I'm talking about your financial endurance. Because if saving to a 401k is the extent of your effort, it is time for you to start shaping up. And Ed Sedell is here to help you do that with The Retirement Trainer. It's his podcast to help you examine your financial stamina and learn the questions you should be asking and areas to focus on to help you get to that place you've been working so hard for, a happy, comfortable retirement. And it's not as hard as some might have made you believe. Ed's broken it down into 5 simple steps. It's the retirement fitness plan, which he personally created to help clarify key areas of your financial life. Learn more about the retirement fitness plan at egsifinancial.com. Then subscribe, follow, and listen to The Retirement Trainer on Apple Podcasts, your iHeart app, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. Investment advisory services offered through EGSI Investment Management, DBA EGSI Financial Group, a registered investment advisor. Insurance and annuities offered through EGSI Financial Services, Inc., Ohio License Number 102-0619.